This is episode 44 of the Home and Family Culture Podcast. I'm Jody Chafee. In this episode, I'm talking with Bonnie Simon of Maestro Classics. Welcome to the Home and Family Culture Podcast, where I discuss how families can discover and design their collective vision, values, beliefs, and traditions that influence their family culture. In this podcast, I interview experts who offer tips and tools to inspire families in this process of developing their family culture, and also successful individuals whose success was influenced by their family culture growing up. Be sure to check out the show notes for this and every episode at homeandfamilyculture.com, where you can subscribe for my weekly newsletter filled with updates on the podcast and blog, as well as other tidbits of information I like to add. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, or YouTube. Please subscribe to your favorite medium. You can also find me on social media at Family Culture Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest, and at _FamilyCulture on Twitter. Be sure to comment, follow, like, rate, and share. But enough about all of that. Let's get to the episode. Thank you for listening.
Good music can elicit this wide range of emotions.
Yeah.
It can, you know, make you sad. It can make you happy. It can make you want to tap your feet, make you want to sing. And that's something that sometimes doesn't happen with words.
Bonnie Ward Simon is president of Maestro Classics, the award-winning classical music company which produces the Stories in Music series for children and families featuring the London Philharmonic Orchestra. From 1989 to 1998, Bonnie was the executive director of the Washington Chamber Symphony, the resident chamber orchestra at the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. She has served as an advisor to Scholastic Publications and is an internationally published writer in the fields of music and children. Bonnie Ward Simon holds degrees in music at Vassar College and music education from New Jersey State College, as well as Japanese labor relations, modern Japanese history, and ancient Chinese history from Columbia University. She has also taught middle school music, worked in administration at Carnegie Hall, and written extensively for Washington Parent Magazine. Before moving to Washington, D.C., she served on the boards of directors of Carnegie Hall, the Guggenheim Museum of Art, and New York City Opera. Bonnie is the mother of Basil and Sebastian Simon, the stepmother of David, Daniel, James, and Adam Simon, and the pack leader of Lulu Simon, their golden retriever. She loves to sail, skis in the winter, travels, sews, knits, paints, and delights in the seasonal changes in Central Park. Welcome, Bonnie.
Thank you.
I loved reading that bio. You are so diverse and accomplished and eclectic. And
well,
that's wonderful.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a delight to be here. I always like to talk about music and children.
Good, because I'm excited to talk about this topic. Music is a big part of my life, and the way that it influences our culture is so important too. So tell us more about, I want to go into more about Maestro Classics, and what was your inspiration behind starting those?
Well, if I could begin really at the very beginning, it began with my two-year-old son, Basil. His father was a conductor, and Basil was interested only in books and music. He had no interest in toys. And so we read to him extensively, and I took him to concerts. So mostly at that age, I took him to his father's rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I guess he was almost three, he had been to all the rehearsals and he had been to the dress rehearsal and he had behaved very well. He sat so quietly and he said, "Can I come to the concert tonight?" Wow. And I softened. And so I thought, well, I will make sure I have seats that are close to the back of the hall. I will make sure I have seats on the aisle. I will take a babysitter in case this does not work out the way he thinks it's going to, or I hope it's going to. And we arrived at this sold-out concert. So there were a few eyebrows raised as this rather small person was sitting in a very nice seat, and we had people who were standing behind the back rows. But he looked quite smart there, sitting there, very much in attention. And the lights went down, and the concertmaster came out from the side of the stage and tuned the orchestra. And then there's always that sort of pregnant pause before the door opens and the conductor walks from the side of the stage onto the podium. Mm-hmm. And Stephen got about halfway there, and suddenly Basil was out of his seat, arms in the air, said, "Dad!" Oh. And I thought I would die. I handed him quickly to the babysitter. She raced up the aisle. There was one last scream before the soundproof door closed. And I thought, oh my God. So I had hundreds of people looking at me. And I always said it was the nicest thing Stephen ever did for me. He stood at the podium. He turned around and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry. That was my son." And at that point, you know, everybody sort of laughed, breathed a sigh of relief. It was over and the concert began. But it was from that experience where I said, here's a child who lives for music, who knew all the musicians on the stage, who wanted to be there, but this was the wrong place. And so I really began to look for family concerts to take him to, because I said, you know, I'm not going through this again. We have to find the right place. And I went to many, many concerts, and I left each one feeling that they thought classical music was boring and a bitter pill. Mm-hmm. And so they brought in clowns. They brought in mimes. They did all sorts of things, really, to distract from the music. And I came back finally and said to Stephen, "The orchestra is in town in Washington on Friday and Saturday nights. I think that we could develop some children's concerts where parents and children could listen together and learn together." Yeah. Because I do believe when you look at my generation, the reason we go to concerts is because we had a parent or a grandparent who took us. And by and large, that's the way most audiences are created. Someone who has the love wants to share it with a child. So I said, I've had a lot of experience teaching fairly unknown things, Japanese, Chinese, to people. And classical music is the most abstract of all music. In fact, probably the most abstract of all arts. It's there and then it isn't there. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear it. And so I said, I think maybe we could create concerts that would be different. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this would be a sleepy little project. And then the chief critic for the Washington Post came to the first concert and did a full page with picture and said, these are the best things since Leonard Bernstein. And with that, we had hundreds of families on the waiting lists for the next year. So the concept of children and parents learning together, because I really do believe that unless you grow up in a family where they have gone to concerts and taken you, or where they play instruments, or if you took college music 101, then where else do you learn about classical music? We just don't have a place in our culture for people. So many adults feel very intimidated by the idea. And they also go to concerts and they say, oh, I always say, if you go to a movie and you come back and you say, it was terrible, don't go. And you go to an art exhibit and you say, my child could have painted better pictures. I don't know why those things are there. But when they go to a classical music concert and it's dull, they say, I guess I just don't understand classical music. And what I want to do is shake them and say, no, actually, that was a pretty boring performance. If you heard a better performance of that piece, you would understand why it's considered a great work. So the idea was that in these concerts, parents would learn with their children. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I created them, I had five people with music degrees in my office working in the orchestra office. And I would hand the script to each one of them and say, did you learn something new? And if they hadn't, I would go back to the drawing boards. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the nicest compliments I ever got were from the members of the orchestra who said, these are the concerts we want our children to go to and to have that love of music. So the concerts grew out of that, and we continued to have more and more concerts, which eventually led to my saying to Stephen, I think Peter and the Wolf should be out there every year for parents to take their kids to. This is the great work to introduce kids to the class, to the symphony orchestra. This is the really best way, our stories with narrator, to introduce children to the symphony orchestra. So Stephen took a deep breath and looked at me and said, all right, Smarty, what are you going to do with the other half of the program? And I said, oh, I hadn't thought about that. So that we talked about it, and that really began our decision to create new works for narrator and orchestra, because we really do feel that if there's a story with the music, the children are engaged, mm-hmm. and they begin to link the music with the story, and somehow music is then part of it.
Yeah.
So that began the Stories and Music Project. And every year we created a new work for narrator and orchestra that went with Peter and the Wolf. Mm-hmm. And every year people would come backstage and say, well, we bought our tickets for Peter and the Wolf, but we really loved your Swan Lake, or we really loved your Tortoise and the Hare. Where can we find a recording? And we said, well, you can't. They don't exist. These were created just for these programs. And maybe someday, but we probably won't repeat them for 5 or 6 years here. So finally, in I think 2005, we took a deep breath and we said, we should make these available to children everywhere, and we should record them. So we had a couple of things that we wanted to make sure of. First was that we had really world-class performances. Mm-hmm. Because so often for children, companies license music that's old and tired and cheap, and I understand that.
Or tickery. tinny. That's what I hear kids' music. It's like, this is very tinny sounding.
That's right. Or maybe it's by synthesizers now, mm-hmm. even. And so we went to London and we recorded with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, which is one of the great recording orchestras of the world. And then when we came back, we said, what else should be on this CD to share the experiences that we had given parents and children in the concert series? Yeah. And one of them was that I had always written program booklets. I said, you have to give a child something that is socially acceptable. How many parents go to concerts and have not read the stage bill cover to cover by the end of the program? And yet you give that to a child, he can't read that. You need something that's in 14-point type, and you need to have some games in it so that if his attention lags a little bit, there's something that he can do that's socially acceptable in that situation. You have to give the parent the pencil as they come in when they take their ticket, because I've been the parent without the pencil. When there's a game there, it's not good. Those programs, always booklets, always included information on the composer and the times. And I thought, well, if people are listening to this in their car, there should be a spoken track that includes this information. And then I said another component had always been that we wanted to include different musical genres, because so often people think that, well, classical music is good music, but all that popular music, that's really not so good music. And so for each CD, we actually tried to find some other musical genre where we could do something with a theme and include it there, so a child would know that you can listen to classical music, but you also can enjoy a heavy metal shredder guitarist as there is on Swan Lake. And we went out and we found one of the 10 top shredders in the world and had him do a version of the Swan Lake theme for us. And then I said, we should have a track where Stephen's talking about the music, because the way he talked to his 6 sons about music and what to listen for, and did you hear that theme, and you know it comes back this way, I thought that would be a really special thing for parents to be able to sort of listen in on. Mm-hmm. So that was always track 4. And then after that, we said people should be invited to listen again, sometimes with narration, sometimes without, because they are astounded at how much more they hear. Mm-hmm. It's just like this sort of awakening, these clouds separate, and you say, oh, I didn't hear that. Oh, yeah, you know, that is there. It does work that way. And then finally, we ended each one with a participatory track, because I always tried to have things in the concerts where kids could sing, tap their foot, do something. So there's always a play along or sing along or dance along track at the end, because being part of the music is always the most fun.
Wow, I love everything. I've listened to Peter and the Wolf with my kids, and Swan Lake, and mm-hmm. Casey at Bat, and Justice in the Hare, and they were all so amazing, so engaging. And it's like you say, like especially Peter and the Wolf, I love the way that it starts out by explaining, when you hear this sound, this is this person in this story, or this animal in the story. And so it's very engaging, and it piques their interest. Like, oh, I did hear that. Oh, this is the duck, or this is the wolf, or this is the hunters, and so they engage in it,
mm-hmm. and they can listen to it more than once.
Yeah,
I think is the great thing. One of the greatest compliments came from a homeschooling mother at a conference when I was there at a table demonstrating the CDs and to another woman, and she came up and she said, oh, you should buy these. She said, my son has worn out Mike Mulligan Steam Shovel. She said, I'm back here buying another one. Uh-huh. I didn't realize you could wear out a CD, but obviously the child listened and listened. And you know, part of our idea was to make sure that the music was good enough so that parents would be willing and happy to hear it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when the parents enjoy it too, that's a big deal. That is a big deal. Awesome. Wow. Thank you for telling that. That's, I feel even more inspired to listen to it again and again. So thank you. I want to talk more about family culture now and then relate it to music. So what is your thoughts? What do you think of family culture when you hear that word?
I think of soil in the garden, which may sound a little odd, but if you think about it, if the soil is rich, if you're enriching it all the time, if you're turning it over, if you're composting, your plants grow in ways that they don't with commercial fertilizer, and if you're not so careful about how the soil is. And I think that mix, which is almost a crucible, is out of that comes all of their interests, their values, and they will carry them for the rest of their lives. You don't have, my mother always said, and perhaps it was this extreme, but she said it's all over by the age of 3. And, you know, I think she was referring to habits for brushing your teeth and other things like that. But in those early years, what happens in the family is more influential than anywhere else they will be. It's more influential than school, than friends, and that really rich family culture will give them fulfilled lives. Yeah. And I think you fill that family culture with books and with music and with travel and meeting different kinds of people. And the more you enrich that, the more they will grow.
That nourishing that soil.
Yeah, yes.
That gives them the nourishment that they need to grow and flourish. And I mean, then here in Virginia, I have clay in my backyard, and I'm like, this would make really bad, you know, I can't grow anything here. And so I have to intentionally figure out how to get good soil.
Yes.
You know, I have to figure out, like, maybe I need to build containers or get pots or, you know, things like that. And to cultivate that soil. And that's the way that I think that our family cultures are, is that to be intentional about what we put in the soil allows us to be intentional about how those plants grow.
I think intentional is a very good word for that.
It's become my word, like my word for all of family culture, I think, in a lot of ways. Most of the time when it comes up about family culture, it is being intentional and you know, having a vision, having values, you know, figuring out where, what you come together and agree on is your family culture.
Yes.
Because you have to talk it out and be intentional and agree.
Yes.
And what those values and vision is for your family. Mm-hmm. So thank you. I love that image. That was beautiful. So how does listening to music cultivate our soil?
Well, think about a movie without a soundtrack. And in a way, music can be the soundtrack for your life. Mm-hmm. So if you put it on while you're cooking dinner, it's going to be a different experience. If you put it on in the car, as opposed to just handing the children the iPad, which is the easy thing to do, and, you know, we've all done it at mile 350. but to think about the listening component and to put it there and to try to integrate it into your life. You know, there are many places where you can. If you're walking the dog, if you're just sitting quietly on a park bench, you can sing a song. Mm-hmm. I think that it's really important just to be conscious that this is a possible addition to your life. And if you take a moment to say, I know we're rushing to get to the dentist appointment, but I always keep music in the car, then you can put the music on while you drive there. Mm-hmm. I always said there are three places you should always have some kind of a music producing machine. There's so many different ways these days, but always in your car, always in your kitchen, and always in your bedroom, mm-hmm. so that the computer isn't there, but you can listen to music and stories at night.
I love that. I love that soundtrack of your life. It's so true. You know, when you were talking about, you know, hearing the symphony, and when you go, it's like telling a story, and the music and the story really go together in so many ways. And your life is like a story in a lot of ways. And then also the music tells the story. And sometimes, you know, we listen to a music that we heard when we were little or something, and those feelings come back, and the stories and the, you know, the love that you felt or the excitement or whatever it is that you felt comes back.
Well, I say that music is like smells. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can probably remember the smell of your grandmother's house, or you go to the ocean and you smell the salt air. And it brings back these memories of when you were with a grandmother, when you were at the beach. And music can do that. And I've often said that if you listen to these works with your children now, they will hear them 30 years from now, and they will be back on your lap, mm-hmm. you know, in their minds, and how they feel that closeness will be there.
Absolutely. What do you think that it matters, the type of music, though, that we are introducing to our children or playing in the background? What difference does it make, the type of music that we have?
Well, my husband always said, and I think actually Duke Ellington was the first person who said there are two kinds of music, good and bad. And I think if you remember that there is good and bad music in every genre. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think that what I always say is you want to have a musical palette, which is filled with many colors and many different kinds of music. And jazz is great. There's great pop music. There are great singers, you can have opera, you can have classical music. I just think that you want classical music to be on that palette as one of the options, not the only option. People hear a lot about classical music being good for brain development. And the fact of the matter is that classical music is complex. It's probably the most complex musical form. And therefore, it's a brain exercise. I mean, you're just sort of massaging your brain and getting it to work in different ways. But it doesn't mean that it's the best kind of music. I think the other thing that makes classical music sort of special is that because of its complexity, it can be performed in different ways, and it can be listened to over and over again, and you hear more and more and more. Mm-hmm. It's never the same. And some of that is the conductor or the orchestra. Some of it is just you're hearing more. Mm-hmm. You know, as when we have you re-listen on a Maestro Classics CD and you see how much more you hear. When you go back and hear another piece of classical music, you will hear more in a way that sometimes doesn't happen in some other forms of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I took a music appreciation class once in college, and, you know, it was interesting. People would bring in different CDs, and we had to listen to them to try to kind of build an affinity for different types of music, you know, and mm-hmm. and I always think about that and how so many times people will turn on music and they're like, oh, I can't stand that, and they just turn it off, and they just don't even want to give it a chance. But I think what you said is really interesting, that in every genre there's good and bad music. I think that there's definitely in a way, you know, you can find good in just about every genre. And I think it comes back to, like you said, that you have in this one, like a metal shredding guitar, you know?
Yes.
I just think if my kids wanted to play guitar, I would want to show them an example of somebody who can really shred, you know?
Yes.
And just that would just pique their, you just get so excited about that music. And I would want to also, you know, help my kids grow an affinity for different kinds of music, because different kinds of music carry with it different cultural significance. Yes. And so, you know, and I mean, I want to, you can be intentional about what kind of cultural significance you want to bring into your home. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's every family is going to be different in that regard. But I think it's important too that, you know, we try to find the good things, especially with classical music. And I think that what's so wonderful about Maestro Classic is that it's a great way to introduce families who are unfamiliar with classical music or feel like, oh, this is boring, or, you know, things like that.
Right.
Or, you know, it's a great introduction and a way to, like, a segue into growing an appreciation and an affinity for something that is unfamiliar at first. Mm-hmm. But then as you grow, you gain that and grow that affinity for it. And I think that classical music is absolutely a worthy genre to try and grow that affinity for, because, like you said, it is an exercise for your brain, and there is a cultural significance to classical music, because you understand, you can learn more about history, you understand more about, you know, different, I don't know how you describe, like, there's a, just a cultural...
It's part of our cultural fabric. It's
yeah.
part of art and architecture and history.
Yeah.
And so exactly. It is one of those pieces that make up our cultural fabric. And it's a shame if kids aren't introduced to it. And I also find sometimes that parents don't know where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it started with someone asking me about their teenage son. And I said, there's a site on the web called, kickassclassical.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they have chosen the most popular 100 pieces of classical music. And they are a movement from a symphony, none of them are more than, 3 to 5 minutes long maximum. And they actually have gone out and found good recordings of these. And you can, for 99 cents, you can buy one. And so I said, well, think about giving your teenager 99 cents a week and have them just click down through those, listen, and then pick one that they like. And I guarantee they will find something there because, you know, whether it's Carmina Burana being, you know, raucous and loud, or whether it's something they have heard, Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings at a very sad place in the movie, they recognize it. Mm-hmm. And then they click, they buy it, it's theirs, and they own it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you really get to know a piece of music, you do own it, and it's with you forever. So that's an exciting thing. But it's also a very good thing for parents who say, I don't know anything about classical music. I don't know where to begin. You know, maybe they've heard of Bach and Handel, but maybe not. And so they probably, on that list, I'm sure they have heard these things. They just didn't know what they were.
Yeah. My husband really loves listening to movie scores like that. And my kids will listen to it and go, oh, this is what's happening in the movie. It's so funny. My little kids, they will hear it and, oh, this is when Simba's running away from the from the wildebeest.
But that's
they
great.
Recognize, and it's so awesome to listen to them. And they do. They make it their own. And it's so, it's such a great way to introduce.
It is. The dean of the Oberlin Conservatory of Music said to me once, John Williams may be considered the greatest composer of the 20th century in the end. And, you know, there were those people who sort of bristled, but he said he's had a tremendous influence.
Yeah. What advice can you give families who want to create a growth mindset around music for their kids who are trying to learn an instrument? And how can we be encouraging without being militant?
Ah, yes.
Right? We've all heard of the tiger mom.
I have been the practice witch, but be patient. Mm-hmm. And you have to be patient on a number of fronts. The first front is choosing an instrument is like falling in love. Mm. Usually the first person you fall in love with is not the person you stay with forever. Occasionally it happens, but, you know, very often it takes several tries to find the right person. Mm-hmm. And musical instruments are very much the same way. So if your child says, first, I want to play the trumpet, and then has 3 months of lessons and says, I don't really like the trumpet, don't think he's not musical or that he doesn't want to play.
Yeah.
Offer other alternatives. You know, take him to a music school. Have him listen to sounds. Say, well, what about another instrument? So I always say rent the first instrument so you're not upset if they change their mind. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been a big investment for you. Be patient about how long they can practice. Sometimes 5 minutes is all they can do. Mm-hmm. And if they can do 5 minutes, but they do it every day or maybe before breakfast and before dinner, and then maybe it will go in a month to 10 minutes that mm-hmm. they can do it. But if you're not forcing them, putting glue on their butt on the piano bench or wherever they are, you have a much better chance of their enjoying the experience. I also think that it's important for them to listen to music that has whatever the instruments they might be considering mm-hmm. play. So a recording of a flute sonata or a clarinet concerto, that children are attracted to different sounds. And if they haven't been introduced to them or if they haven't even heard them, then it's rather a shot in the dark for them of what they should play. Just because you have a piano in the house does not mean that they have to play the piano. Learning to play the piano is a great thing, but it's not the only instrument. And one also needs to remember that playing the piano is lonely. That if you're playing another instrument, you'll be able much more easily to play with other children mm-hmm. or young people. So, you know, there are youth bands, you know, town youth bands that are around that children can join, or you have Suzuki violin studios where it's always group playing. Mm-hmm. And that's very good for kids. It's a nice experience to be able to play with other children.
I heard recently too that if you want your child to play the piano, that it's actually a really difficult instrument to start out on because their hands are so little. And so that was interesting to learn.
Yes.
That.
Yes.
I was kind of shocked to hear that, because at least where I am, everybody wants their kids to learn piano. And yeah. They try to start them out with so little. And then I read about the Suzuki method. And, you know, what I got out of it was basically our kids will model what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want them to play the piano, then we ought to learn it
yourself.
Or if, yeah. Well, or if we want them to play the violin.
Yes.
And we need to be able to go home and pick up the violin, even if we just play with it. Like, you know, just demonstrating that this is something that mom and dad are interested in, then the kids go, oh, that's something that mom and dad do, then that's something that's okay for me to do too.
Right.
And so modeling is a big part of that.
Suzuki has been enormously successful with this method, and you as a parent do have to get yourself a violin, and you have to learn with your child. But it's a nice experience. And again, that loneliness factor is taken away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is that you don't want to be judgmental. The teacher can tell your child that he needs a metronome and that he's not playing in time. You're really, as the parent, to be the cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's hard. You know, you've heard three wrong notes, but he sat there for 10 minutes and you have to say, well, that was nice job today.
Mm-hmm.
No, you did 10 minutes, not, you know, I heard 27 wrong notes. So the other thing to remember is don't ask them to play for your friends. Let them offer.
Mm.
I hear this from many, many children who say, oh, she made me play. It was so awful, because they're a little self-conscious. And if they don't feel ready, it puts a lot of pressure on them that you don't want them to have. Another thing to remember is the teacher is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And the first teacher should make your child love to play, should love her or him, should love to go there. It doesn't matter if they're the greatest technician, the greatest talent, the greatest teacher. If that teacher can instill a love of the instrument, then your child is set on a road for life. And after that, you will have plenty of time to find great teachers who will give them wonderful technique and things. But the New York Times years ago did a very interesting study where they took 100 people in 100 who were at the top of their fields in 100 different occupations. And they said to each one of them, well, they tried to find, was there a commonality in the experiences of these people in all of these fields that you could sort of say, well, that was the one thing that made a difference. And when all was said and done, they said, the first teacher I had made me love it, whether it was biology or chemistry or music or art. And they said, after that, you can do all sorts of things, but if you begin. So I think you need to really tune in on your child and see if it's a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not, to feel that it's okay to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the line about schools. It's not a good fit is the easiest way to extricate yourself from one of these situations. So I have found it's not a good fit, we've found. You know, lays no blame on either party for doing it, and you move on.
Yeah.
Again, you want to have that conversation with your child. You know, how was the lesson? How did it go? You know, what do you think of her? Does she have a nice dog? You know, to begin to have a dialogue about it with them. And I guess the only other thing I put down in my notes somewhere here was, the most difficult thing about practicing is opening the case.
Mm.
Once the case is
open
and the instrument is out, you can begin. But with that in mind, having a set time to practice takes a lot of the anxiety, or a child will find it sort of arbitrary. Suddenly you think it's time for them to practice. Well, they don't feel like practicing now, but you do. So if it's just, you know, 6:30 is the time they practice for 10 minutes, then 6:30 should be it. And it's very easy to say 6:30 practice time.
What stood out to me about what you said is something that's been coming up in my life a lot, is that concept of having a mentor. And the mentor is somebody who has a self-interest in the child's development. Yes. And the relationship with them, and also has a passion for what they're teaching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a big part of what the mentor's responsibility is, and to counsel with the child, teach them the expectations, or, you know, the language of, yes, of this new situation that they're coming into. And so a mentor is a really powerful resource for helping your child to develop, because they do have a self-interest in that too.
There are very few opportunities for children to have mentors. And music lessons are one of those where it's possible. I know that my son had a very tight relationship with a music teacher of his. And they talked about lots of things that were not about the notes on the page. Mm-hmm. And it ranged from, how do you practice? How do you attack a problem? And he said to me, now he's in his 30s, he said, you know, Denny really taught me how to work out a problem. You know, how do you take it apart? And I know Denny was very strict, and there were times when Basil retreated to his bathroom to cry because he couldn't play it, and it was, you know, very sad. But, you know, Denny had standards, but there was no doubt that they had this very close relationship.
I think those standards are also what compel. If you have a good relationship with your mentor, with the child mentor relationship, then that's really what's compelling for the child. Yes. Yeah, if the mentor does have these a little bit higher expectations and wants to see them progress, then the child gets that sense of responsibility to fulfill the expectation. Right. And to want them to like what they're doing, you know,
confidence.
Yeah.
To have the confidence to feel that someone thinks they can do it.
Yeah,
you know,
and that they care.
To reach the start, yes.
That they want to see them progress. Mm-hmm. So is it ever too late for kids to start learning an instrument?
No.
What is that? Is there an optimal age?
Well, I can say that my father started to play the violin at 26 and played every day of his life into his 90s, and it gave him great joy. He was not a great violinist, but he could play standard repertoire and had a wonderful time doing it. I don't recommend beginning the violin at 26, but it's possible. I think the question often is, you know, three-year-olds can begin Suzuki, but that's very early. There are not a lot of three-year-olds who are ready to do this. So you shouldn't feel that just because your three-year-old is not ready for Suzuki, that there's something wrong and they're not musical. Mm-hmm. Many kids begin Suzuki at 5 or 6 and do very well, and it works. If you have a child who's ready, that's terrific. They have done studies where children who have had early music, sort of parent-child music classes, then when they have tested them later on, they find they have what's considered greater musical ability. So what are parent-child music classes? Basically, they're singing songs. Mm-hmm. You with your child, they're banging on drums. They're marching around. Mm-hmm. They're simply having a musical experience. And frankly, they were some of the nicest experiences I had with my children with it when they were young. They were really fun. And if you can find a group where you can do this, that's great. Most people think about beginning instruments at maybe 6 and first grade. Many people's first experience is in 3rd or 4th or 5th grade when the school has a band or an orchestra, and they can choose an instrument then, which certainly also is a good age to begin. There are children who switch instruments in high school. I had a child who went from playing the trumpet very well to playing the French horn. So yeah. those things do happen. I think you need to introduce it. Again, be patient. You're the salesman in a way for the idea. And you watch and see when it seems like it's the right moment, and you try, and I think you back off if it's not working and say, we'll try this again a little later. Not just give up and say, I don't have a musical child.
Yeah. I think going back to what you said about having their first teacher be the person that helps them to develop a love of the instrument, we as parents can help to do that. And I think that it's crucial, because when kids develop that love, then they'll continue. I think that if they have too much pressure and they feel too much strain, then either they quit or they burn out early, because they don't develop that love.
That's true. Also, to find a teacher who is willing, when you have the 14-year-old boy who doesn't really want to play, you know, his classical repertoire, who's willing to give him some jazz. Mm. My husband always thought that his mother was incredibly clever, because he had taken piano from the age of 4 and played very well. And he got to those early teenage years when it seemed like sort of a geeky thing to do. And she went out and found him a wonderful jazz piano teacher. Mm. And for the next 2 or 3 years, that's what he did. And he then, of course, went back to classical music, but he was always great to have at a party. I mean, he'd sit down at any piano and can play, you know, any popular tune. And we'd go to restaurants in Europe and he'd sit in at the piano and people would put money in the cup for him, you know, which we always laughed at. But someone who's wise enough to say, okay, you don't want to play this? Maybe you'd like to play that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's so, I love that. And then another thing that I wanted to say about music and creating and allowing our kids to develop that skill is, you know, I was talking to my sister recently and she said that her youngest has really fallen into piano and he loves it, especially because it's a coping tool for him. Whenever he feels stressed or anxiety, things like that, he can sit down at the piano and feel really a lot better. And it really dawned on me and occurred to me, because I've also had conversations with people about addiction and things like that, that so often in our culture, we fall into coping by consuming. And, you know, that's so often. But if we can try and create this transition to coping by production, by producing something,
That's a nice idea.
It's so important. That could completely change so much about our culture. And producing could be music, it could be writing, it could be singing, it could be exercise, it could be, you know, any number of things where you're producing something. When you are out there, when you choose to cope by producing something, that is actually way more recovering, you know, way more redeeming of your stress and your anxiety than consumption will ever be.
Yes.
You will never be satisfied when you consume.
No.
But true. Production, you can. It gives you that satisfaction.
I think we're living in an age where that's going to become increasingly difficult and something we're going to have to work towards, because we are fed so much media, so much entertainment, so much on the screen, that to turn that around and to be a producer as opposed to a consumer of all of this is an issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I walk around the park here and am surprised at the parents who are looking at their cell phones and the children who are looking at their iPads. Mm-hmm. And I think, we should turn this around a little bit. You two should be talking to each other.
Yeah. Well, conversation is a great way to produce.
Yes.
You're in service.
Exactly.
You know, anything that you creating connection or creating something, that's production. And
yes,
that's so much more fulfilling than consuming will ever be, because you can never buy enough toys. You can never buy enough food. You can never, you know, whatever.
You can never eat enough chocolate.
Eat enough chocolate. That's right. Right. But to imagine if you could turn that around, how much more productive we could be with the amount of that we consume to
yes.
equal the amount of that we could produce. That would be mind-blowing.
Yes.
Right?
Something for us all to work towards.
Yeah. This is what it means. Because so many times people talk about being, you know, raising your kids to be producers. You think, oh, well, I don't know how to teach them to be entrepreneurs. But it's not. It's not. You don't have to take it to that level. It's just to be a producer is just create the culture of being creative.
Yes. Maybe it's making a Lego car as opposed to just looking at someone else making one.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. Well, Bonnie, thank you so much. I really have loved this conversation, and thank you for your tips and ideas. Where can we find you on social media, or, you know, if you learn more, where can we find Maestro Classics?
Well, the first place to go is maestroclassics.com. M-A-E-S-T-R-O classics.com, where we have lots of not only the recordings that you can purchase, both as CDs and digital downloads, but we have educational materials, we have curriculum guides that are free, and I have many, many articles on children and music that I have posted there on the website. And you can also find us on Maestro Classics on Facebook and Twitter. So we're out there. You just have to remember how to spell maestro.
Yeah. M-A-E.
Yes.
S-E-R-O.
So, well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for listening. And thank you for listening all the way through to the end. Because that last little bit about where I'm talking about being a producer versus a consumer, I really think that that is the whole crux of this whole message. That our values and our family culture need to reflect something that is about being creative or active or productive in some way, so that our kids can lean more towards being producers rather than so much of being consumers. And so that's why we need to be intentional about our family culture, to create, to inspire, to lead our kids into lives that are fulfilling and inspiring and impactful. And to do that for ourselves too. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your support. Please go to homeandfamilyculture.com to check out my show notes and any links that Bonnie and I talked about. Again, I'd appreciate if you could like and rate and share and comment and review, and go check me out on Instagram at Family Culture Podcast. I really appreciate your support and your interaction with that community on Instagram and on Facebook, and for sharing. I really love to hear your feedback. Thank you so much.